From the Moon Broadcast Center, it's Air Talk. I'm Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle today. Our country is looking for answers after a week of violence, including a hate-filled attack on Latino people at a Walmart in El Paso. Terry McAuliffe was the governor of Virginia during the Charlottesville white supremacist rally that woke many people up to the present-day danger of racist violence. Governor McAuliffe is here in studio. He's going to talk about his new book, Beyond Charlottesville. That's coming up. Welcome to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle for another day. Larry's going to be back on Monday. Well, Monday is also the two-year anniversary of the Charlottesville white supremacist rally that ended in the murder of a counter-protester named Heather Heyer. Dozens more were injured by a neo-Nazi who drove his car into a crowd of anti-racist demonstrators that day. And the violence that weekend forced a national reckoning with the reemergence of white power ideology and racially motivated violence. And that ugly reality has been punctuated again this week by the horrific mass shooting in El Paso, where 22 people were killed by a gunman who targeted Latinos and immigrants. Former Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe led his state through the Charlottesville attack and its aftermath, and he's the author of a new book, Beyond Charlottesville, Taking a Stand Against White Nationalism. And Governor McAuliffe is in the studio with us right now. Welcome, Governor. Thanks for being on Air Talk.
Thanks, Libby. Thanks for having me.
So the first half of your book goes into this play-by-play of what happened that weekend in August of 2017. And then later we read you addressing what's next for the country, solutions, your after-action report. First off, I just want to say one of the more emotional passages is when you talk about your grief over your friends, the state troopers who were killed in a helicopter crash that day, Burke Bates and Jay Cullen. And you knew them personally, your family knew them personally. And I just want to kind of give you a quick moment to talk about them and the way that your family remembers them, because it's almost 2 years now since you lost them.
Yeah, and it was tough. It was a really tough day, obviously, with Heather Heyer, 32-year-old, who was a counter-protester there to protest against hatred and neo-Nazis and white supremacists. But that afternoon, the state police helicopter, the one I always use as governor, crashed with the Jay Cullen, who had been my pilot for 3.5 years, and a former member of my security detail who had just become a pilot. And it was personal because they were close to our family. You know, the executive protection unit, you know, they're with you 24 hours, 7 days a week. Burke was a real character. And that day, you know, two sons, two husbands, two fathers were killed. And I went by the house, both homes that evening to see the families and to see Karen and Amanda, and each of them had two children. It's just heartbreaking. And you think, but for Charlottesville, but for the Unite the Right rally, Heather Heyer would be alive and the state troopers would be alive.
I love the memory that you share of one of the troopers driving your daughter to school and like getting on a loudspeaker and announcing her arrival. She was very nervous about arriving at school, and it just seemed like a really lovely relationship. Yeah.
Well, Burke was a character, Libby, I'll tell you that. Yeah. And that was – so I get elected governor. We moved to Richmond, and Sally is, you know, about to start freshman in high school. She's in a new city, doesn't know anybody. First day of school, she's going, you know, state police are driving her to school, her dad's governor. Ugh. You know, none of it's good for.
So embarrassing.
Yeah, the
Dad.
Whole thing is a wreck. And she's pulling up in a big, you know, black state police car. And she just wants to slink in very quietly. And as she pulls up, she tells Burke sort of go off so she can get up. Nobody can see her because all the seniors are there to wait. Burke turns on the siren and lights, and Sally McAuliffe is here, says on the loudspeaker. And then the last time I saw Burke, which was really sad, I mean, he was a real character. He had come over just as he was moving over to the helicopter unit and said, Governor, I had a son who's a captain of the Marine Corps, and he was in Iraq at the time, deployed on duty. And he said, I got a great care package for Jack. I said, oh, great. What'd you send him? He said, well, I sent him some cigars and some magazines. I said, oh, Newsweek time. I said, a little more colorful than that. Well, whatever. And then he said, oh, and I sent him some Irish whiskey. I said, what? I said, you can't send Irish whiskey to the military in a Muslim country. And, oh, no, Governor. I put it in a Listerine bottle. I mean, he was a character. I talked to my son a month later. The package finally came, magazines made of cigars, with a little note from the military inspectors don't ever have this person send alcohol again.
Nice.
But that
try.
Was Merck. He was a real character. So what a tragedy that day to think in these neo-Nazis. And I tell you, Libby, the book's about fighting white nationalism. How 1,000 people could come into our city screaming every other word was the F and N word. Every woman was the F and C word. Telling Jews, we're going to burn you like we burned you in Auschwitz. I got to tell you, I just in my life, how did we get to a place in America? They used to wear hoods and they used to do it at night. They don't think they have to do this anymore. 1,000 neo-Nazis and whites, all of them armed, walking through the street, screaming the most vile things I've ever heard against another human being. How did we get to this place in America?
I think there was a certain degree of denial before that event, before we saw the torches in the street.
Yep.
You know, when you hear those chants and you see those images, especially from the campus the night before the rally and then the rally itself and the violence, was it foolish for a lot of people to assume that this ideology was so fringe that it was just harmless?
Probably for a lot of Americans. This was the biggest neo-Nazi white supremacist we had seen in decades. I mean, Friday night at the University of Virginia, you look up on the hill, big dark hill with no lights on it, all you could see were hundreds of torches coming down the hill like a big long snake, chanting, "Jews, you will not replace us," blood and soil, all from 1933, 1934, Nazi Germany. And you just were shocked at it. And then Saturday, the violence that went on Saturday, we had an idea. I mean, that they were coming armed. They wanted to hurt people. I just still to this day am shocked, Libby, at the things they said about fellow human beings. How do you get like this? I mean, you're not born like this. And it was shocking. And it was the book opens with my conversation with Donald Trump that day. The president called me, as they do. They call governors and, you know, when their state has a crisis. And I told the president what was going on. These were horrible people. I told him I declared a state of emergency. I had ended the rally even before it begun. It was supposed to start at noon. And about 11:15, I gave the order to clear the park because we'd seen enough and this was going to get out of hand. I told the president they were horrible people, explained what they had said. I told the president that, you know, this is an opportunity for him. I said Bill Clinton had the issues of Oklahoma City. Barack Obama, of course, had Charleston, Sandy Hook. And I said, you know, George Bush had 9/11. The world is looking at you, Mr. President. You've got to stop. And I said, Mr. President, you got to stop the hate speech. And I dealt with them a lot. I was chairman of the National Governors Association. I had to deal with them on the Muslim ban, on immigration, on health care.
I mean, you knew him ahead of time. He gave to your 2009 campaign back when he was more of
when he was a Democrat.
You know, donating to Democratic campaigns. Yeah.
Listen, Libby, he was Democrat his whole life. I mean, he was pro-choice, pro. I mean, this whole thing is a charade. And I tell the story in the book. So he helped me in 2009. And then I went back again when I was going to run again in early 2011, like January, and said, hey, you know, I'm going to run again. I need your help. And he said, I can't help you this time. I may run for president. I mean, I almost spit out my coffee. I said, president? He said, yeah. I said, well, which party? He said, I don't know yet. I got to figure that out. I mean, you know, the man has no moral core. But so I told him what, you know, this was a real opportunity for him to stand tall, to bring the country together. I told him he's got to stop the hate speech because it's dividing the country. You know, I'd really gotten into battles with him on the, you know, banning those Muslim countries. I had Virginia residents, U.S. citizens, detained at Dulles International Airport for hours at end. These are U.S. citizens, Libby, without access to a lawyer, really? And the ICE raids he was doing in Northern Virginia, I said, you're really hurting my economy. And then he went off on the economy. But anyways, when he finished, he said, you know, you and I, we'll work together on this. I felt very good. So I was going to wait to do my press conference till he did his. And, I waited a half an hour. I waited an hour. I waited an hour and a half. I waited 2 hours. And you know what happened, Libby, is the White House, let it be Bannon or Miller or whoever, got to him and said, no, Mr. President, you are not going to attack neo-Nazis. You're not going to attack white supremacists. In fact, you're not even going to use their names. And sure enough, he came out, never said white supremacist, never said neo-Nazi, and said there were good people on both sides.
We have a clip of that. If we can just get to this comment from the White House following the 2017 August weekend in Charlottesville that ended with the death of Heather Heyer and two Virginia State Police troopers. Here's President Trump from the White House.
You're changing history, you're changing culture, and you had people, and I'm not talking about the neo-Nazis and the white nationalists, because they should be condemned totally. But you had many people in that group other than neo-Nazis and white nationalists, okay? And the press has treated them absolutely unfairly. Now, in the other group also, you had some fine people, but you also had troublemakers.
That's actually the cut from the following days when he did call out white supremacy. If we can play the cut from the White House the day of the attacks, when he spoke about the actual attacks in Charlottesville and refused to name white nationalism.
We condemn in the strongest possible terms this egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence on many sides. On many sides. It's been going on for a long time in our country.
And so, as you heard, his first comments, he's condemning hatred, bigotry, but he says on many sides. That's the way he couches it. And that's what people initially heard from the president of the United States following the Charlottesville attack. A few days later, he comes back. He names white nationalism, but at the same time, he's bringing in comments about the anti-protesters, the counter-protesters who showed up and claimed that they were looking for trouble as well.
But you got to remember, Libby, why he came out after. So when he failed on Saturday, he was resoundingly condemned around the world, but by his own Republicans, the Speaker, Paul Ryan. Orrin Hatch said, you know, my brother didn't fight and lose his death in World War II to allow this neo-Nazi ideology to go on here in America. So Marco Rubio, Trump got crushed by the Republicans, and he knew he had screwed up, and that's why he finally had to come out, but then he doubled down again.
What does that do, in your opinion? We're hearing now this week, El Paso, this terrible attack on Latino people, a lot of folks pointing at the president and saying his rhetoric about an invasion, his rhetoric about sending rapists and murderers from Mexico, all of these comments that are repeated again and again in campaign slogans and on Facebook ads. People are saying, Beto O'Rourke among them, that this is contributing to violence. This commentary after Charlottesville kind of was the, wake up call for some people to say, you know, he's not addressing white nationalism that is presenting itself in the country, and that will lead to violence. Do you believe that? Do you believe that connection between the president and violence?
I've said this for a long time, and I clearly have said it every day since Charlottesville. Charlottesville was his coming out party as a racist and a white supremacist, because he as the president, had to stop this hate speech, and he didn't. He actually, and if you read the book, I've got quotes from David Duke and others, what they said after the president spoke, basically saying the president gave us license to do this. I mean, the book is quoted with all of these knuckleheads and all the things they've said. But Libby, none of this should surprise anybody. When he ran for president, he retweeted neo-Nazi and white supremacist tweets. He said, we want to ban all Muslims from coming into our country, and he called Mexicans rapists and murderers. He has a horrible history, and he has doubled down since he's been president. So what happened in Charlottesville, and it was supposedly about the Robert E. Lee statue being taken down that the city council had voted for. These folks didn't know who Robert E. Lee was. They came to spew hatred. This was their coming out party for the neo-Nazis and the white supremacists. Felt like, and they're quoted in my book, that President Trump, if he can say this, I can say this. So he basically has created this culture in the country that people think it's okay to do what they're doing.
You talked about the Robert E. Lee statue. That is what sparked initially the idea for this rally by the Unite the Right organizers back in 2017. Can you talk about, especially in Virginia, what you saw in terms of that process of beginning to address Confederate monuments, but also through that, the legacy of slavery, the legacy of racism in your state?
And it's people got to understand, Virginia was the capital of the Confederacy. And we still have a lot of the ideology left in Virginia. But I can tell you this, the Confederate flag, the Confederate monuments are offensive to the African-American community. It was for the preservation of slavery. Nobody should kid themselves. That's what it was for. And the people who fought against the Union were traitors to this country. We have I mean, I did what I could as governor. I used executive authority. I took the Confederate flag off the license plate. It's just plain offensive to folks. I tried to lean in on these issues. Under Virginia law, they can't take the local statues down. But Libby should understand, in Virginia, you know, the Confederate War started there with Patrick Henry's speech. It ended there with the Battle of Yorktown. World War One, World War Two, very significant pieces of our history. We have about a dozen statues to those big events. To the Confederate War, 378. And many of them, Libby, were built during massive resistance, Jim Crow laws.
You talked about Jim Crow laws. You addressed felon voting rights when you were governor. You restored over 200,000 felons' voting rights once they had served their sentence.
Yep.
You even sent out voter registration forms along with that. There was a lot of legal back and forth about why you had to send them out individually instead of just, you know, commute them all in general. Was that about correcting the legacy of Jim Crow in Virginia?
Oh, my goodness, at the top of the list. Just so your listeners understand, because in California you may find this, but Virginia was one of two states that permanently disenfranchised you. So if you commit a felony in Virginia, which is $200, so you steal an iPhone or sneakers for $201, you are a felon and you lose your voting rights for the rest of your life. Think of that. This goes back to 1901 when a state senator by the name of Glass put it in our Constitution. And his quote that day, Libby, on the floor of our General Assembly, said, "I'm doing this to eliminate the darkie from being a political factor in Virginia." That was his quote. The southern states, horrible disenfranchisement of African Americans. So I used executive authority to restore these rights. I had the authority, clearly in the Constitution. As soon as I did it, the Republican speaker and Senate leader sued me, took me to the Virginia Supreme Court, which unfortunately one of two states appointed by the legislature. And the court originally came out and said, "We're not going to let Governor McAuliffe do it because no governor's done it before." Well, that's not a constitutional theory. They said he has to do it individually. I said, fine, I'll do it individual. I told my staff, take all 206,000 petitions. Let's go out front of the Capitol to the Civil Rights Memorial. I'm going to sign every damn one if it takes me a week. They then sued me for contempt of court, but I won that case. And today, 200,000 people, Libby, are back voting, and they feel like real citizens of Virginia.
I think that pushback is so interesting, though, the legal challenges to that and everything. It works in a piece with the desire to hold on to a legacy that a lot of people see as racist, as hate-filled. It's, you know, something we want to get to just after this very short break. It's Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle today. Governor Terry McAuliffe, the former governor of Virginia, is in studio with me on Air Talk. And his new book is Beyond Charlottesville, Taking a Stand Against White Nationalism. Back right after this. Air Talk, Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle, Governor Terry McAuliffe, former governor of Virginia, in studio with me. We talked about the statues, the issue of a Robert E. Lee statue in Lee Park in Charlottesville became this flashpoint, this excuse for a rally by white supremacist organizers. The Unite the Right rally is formed. They start advertising online. What do you know about how it evolved ahead of that weekend in August?
Well, when they filed the permit, obviously we swung into action because we knew what a problem this could be. We stood up our fusion center, which is our law enforcement operations. We did a lot of undercover work. We'd worked with the FBI and the DHS. And clearly on these dark websites, we clearly saw that these folks were being told to come to Charlottesville. This was going to be the grand banana of all of these rallies. And they were so fired up. And they were all told to bring weapons and to harm people. So we knew ahead of time that these were going to be very bad people. And as I say earlier, it had nothing to do with Robert E. Lee. This was all about fighting. They wanted a white country. Neo-Nazis wanted to exterminate all the remaining Jews. I've never in my life have seen anything like it. So we knew ahead of time that this was going to be a very, very combustible situation.
And there were signs ahead of time, too, about the violence that had broken out on some college campuses. Here in California, we had Berkeley, a number of very big street brawls between Unite the Right type organizers, neo-Nazi groups, and then anti-fascist groups. And then in Anaheim, we had stabbings ahead of what happened in Charlottesville, neo-Nazi demonstration in Sacramento that ended in stabbings, a Ku Klux Klan rally in Anaheim. I mean, this stuff had been brewing in the year leading up to Charlottesville. And so you had intelligence also about what the chatter was online.
Oh, a lot of chatter online. Very dangerous stuff online. The end result is after Charlottesville, the groups were very hurt greatly, which is good news. A lot of the counter-protesters had taken pictures of the protesters and put them up on social media. Many people lost their jobs. The hot dog vendor worked at the hot dog in Berkeley, famous hot dog stand. He lost a job. A couple Marines got thrown out.
Yeah, that was a disturbing part of the story was, the members of the military that had showed up at this rally. It's shocking, but also there is a history of, rooting out white supremacist ideology in the U.S. military.
Yeah, it exists in our culture. And a lot of people have been indicted, a lot of people charged. James Fields will never see the light of day ever again. He's the young man from Ohio who weaponized his car and killed Heather and hurt 35 different folks. So,
and I want to get to that, Governor McAuliffe. A lot of conversation is happening right now. I know you've had some protesters show up at your book events about what could have been done to control the violence that happened in Charlottesville. I think that some protesters, one that appears in your book, Emily Gorsensky, who's kind of a well-known activist, used to live in Charlottesville. I think she's moved away now. And she argues that her group, her anti-racist protest group, was trying to warn local officials and the city council that there was going to be violence. And she met with, antipathy or resistance. Do you feel like there was enough preparation going into this weekend, knowing that these racists were going to show up? What more could have been done?
Well, and I talk about this in the book. I was very concerned at the state level that the city was not paying attention. In fact, I have a whole memo in the book where my staff has sent it to me for me to call the mayor because it said the city is just not listening. And we sent our state police, sent our fusion center down to brief the city council. And one of the city council members is in there, said it scared the holy daylights out of him. But we continued to warn the city that this was a potential very serious, serious situation. And, I called the National Guard up, which is the first time in 40 years a governor had called him out for a domestic situation. I sent down our state police, but we worked for the city. Just is where we are here. If it's a city event, you're there in a support role. But we knew how, I'm very clear in the book. We knew that this was going to be dangerous. We continued to warn the city that these are very bad actors. And I talk, the book's not about blaming. We try to, everybody there wanted to make sure that everybody was safe. And I remind you that at 11:20 or whatever, I called a state of emergency, cleared the park. I mean, that was the city responsibility, not mine. But I had seen enough. And at this point, we cleared the park by 11:50. The rally was supposed to start at noon, so, literally before it. At that point, we were in pretty good shape. No real serious injuries. No one had gone to a hospital and no property damage at all. So at that point, everything was fine. It was about an hour later when this James Field weaponized his car, and that's what caused the issue. And then, of course, a tremendous mechanical issue that brought the helicopter down.
And it appears to be a crowd control concern. And, being in a city where we do have large demonstrations frequently, we haven't had the same sort of violent clashes between counter-protesters lately that we're seeing in Berkeley. But when you talk about the way that protest was permitted and the way it was kind of jammed into a smaller park, I know that government officials wanted to move it to a larger venue. A judge denied that request.
Yep.
What could have been done in terms of a logistical factor to separate those groups so you didn't have this volatile mix of armed people, of angry people together?
Yeah. First of all, when I talk about at length in the book on the permit. The permit was applied for, and under City of Charlottesville regulations, if you don't take any action in 10 days, it's automatically approved. Unfortunately, the city didn't do anything about it. They should have banned poles, should have banned sticks, should have limited the location, should have limited the amount of time. It should not have been from noon to five at it's now called Emancipation Park. And it never, that permit should never have been approved in the present form. Once you, things started to happen, they did, the city finally came out on Wednesday and said, we got to move it. Because you're right, the key to controlling a protest is to have a buffer zone between the two opposing sides. That is the absolute key to controlling any protest. It was physically impossible. And the city had an agreement with the neo-Nazis and the white supremacists that they would enter into one side of the park. Well, guess what? They didn't honor that commitment. Why you would ever believe the word of a neo-Nazi, I'm not quite sure, but whatever. And so Wednesday they decided that they needed to move it up to McIntyre Park, much bigger park, literally could have controlled everything. And listen, I say in the book, and I love the ACLU, but they sued on behalf of the neo-Nazis and the white supremacists. They sued to say, no, we want it to stay at Emancipation Park.
And you actually, later in the book, also say that in the wake of this, you would like the ACLU to reconsider representing groups like the Klan and groups that have a white supremacist ideology.
Listen, I'm all for First Amendment, and I, you know, you can say what you want. I may not like it, but you don't have the right to come into an area with the intent to do harm. You do not. And the law enforcement should be able to control a situation. If they say we can't control it, that should supersede First Amendment.
But Governor, the ACLU, it's like the underpinning of what they're about, right, is free speech. And well, so do you worry about the abandonment of a group's rights for free speech?
I don't, because you've had court cases, and clearly if interests of public safety supersedes First Amendment. If we cannot keep you safe, you don't have the right to walk into a place armed and hurt people. You don't. And as you know, as I write in the book, many of the ACLU national board members resigned in protest. Several Jewish members said, you know, I'm not going to support an organization that represents neo-Nazis. But and then the judge on Friday night at 9 o'clock came out and sided with the neo-Nazis. Now, I'm just baffled by this. If the city of Charlottesville is telling the judge, we can't control, this is a volatile situation, you can't get 1,000 armed people and 1,000 or 2,000 counterproachers in a size of someone's backyard. You just can't do that. And that is unfortunate. Had it been up at McIntyre Park, you would not have had the skirmishes back and forth. And, you know, you ultimately would not have had the car going through the crowd because it would have been up at a park.
How did you hear first that Heather Heyer had been killed?
So it was, as I say, Brian Moran, who was my Secretary of Public Safety, we were in constant communication. At 11:50, he called me and said, the park has been cleared. The park is secure. Everything's calm now. So we felt actually pretty good at this point. And it was about an hour later, he called and said, have you got your TV on? And I said, yeah. He said, well, you're about to see something. And then he mentioned that this car, we didn't have much information, just the car had gone through the crowd. Burke Bates, who was on surveillance in the state police helicopter, caught the entire thing, which was used as great evidence to get James Fields, thank goodness. And then, you know, we said, then saw the visuals of the car going through this crowd. I mean, awful, awful. And, you know, we didn't find out till much later that Heather and Susan Brough, Heather's mother, is in the book, and she talks how painful it had been, and she didn't know, and someone had found Heather's cell phone on the street. They called it, her brother called it, and, you know, just horrible.
They were trying to find her at, you know, different hospitals, calling around.
And they didn't have her name in any of the hospitals.
Yeah, it's horrible. We do have a quick cut of Susan Brough following Heather's death at a memorial service. And she talks about what Heather believed in and why she showed up to protest racists in her hometown and what her legacy would be. Here's that cut.
And I think the reason that what happened to Heather has struck a chord is because we know that what she did is achievable. We don't all have to die. We don't all have to sacrifice our lives. They tried to kill my child to shut her up. Well, guess what? You just magnified her.
I think that one of the comments that would, you know, stay in people's minds long, long after Charlottesville, you tried to kill my daughter to shut her up, but you just magnified her. That's Susan Brough, mother of Heather Heyer, the protester who was trying to voice her opposition to neo-Nazis who had come to her town of Charlottesville when she was killed by
a white supremacist demonstrator who angrily plowed his car into a crowd. Governor Terry McAuliffe is here with me, former governor of Virginia, with his book Beyond Charlottesville. He's looking back, talking about what occurred that weekend, and also looking forward at solutions and how we can address this problem of hate in our country. Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle today. We'll be back after this news break. Welcome back to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle. Governor Terry McAuliffe in the studio with me right now with his new book, Beyond Charlottesville, Taking a Stand Against White Nationalism. Former governor of Virginia, who is looking back at what occurred during the Unite the Right rally weekend in Charlottesville, the violence there, and what solutions we can look toward to try to prevent future violence. Of course, in a week that has just brought this issue front and center for so many, looking at the violence against Latino people at a Walmart in El Paso on Saturday. And I think the issue of radicalization is on a lot of people's minds. How do we go from people who hold racist beliefs in their hearts, or maybe they're just open to it, and somehow a person who would plow a car into a crowd of protesters, or a person who would bring a gun to target a certain minority group? What can be done about radicalization, and what do we need to know about it?
And listen, I talk about in the book, the one benefit of Charlottesville, as horrible as it was, is one, we greatly diminished these groups. By the time, you know, they've paid a horrible price. But number two, it ripped the scab off of racism in this country. I think for far too long, Libby, people had felt that we had dealt with the issues of racism and didn't exist. You know, it's not a comfortable topic for white people to talk about. They don't want to talk about
it. I was going to say, I think a lot of white people may have thought that way, but I don't think people of color had any illusions, or most of them.
Right. And I'm talking about white people. They like to be in their comfort zone. This ripped it off to say, whoa, 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 you can't be in that comfort zone anymore. It exists. And you got to do something about it. And I talk a lot in the book. And John Lewis writes the foreword for me, Congressman Lewis, the great civil rights leader. And he and I collaborated on the back part of the book about where do we go from here. But, you know, racism exists. And I say, Libby, you know, as long as we have inequities in school, where young African-American children or Latino children are going to not the same quality school as white children, that's racism. Because that child's not going to have the same opportunities that that white child's going to have. As long as we have inequities in housing, on affordable housing, and on health care delivery. And one thing I go into a lot in the book, and as governor, I reformed my criminal justice system in Virginia. It was a very racist system. Sentencing, I'll tell you, you know, I mentioned Lenny Singleton was a young man who I pardoned on my way out the door as governor. Lenny Singleton was a drug addict. He committed 5 robberies to support his habit. The total he stole, Libby, was $535, and nobody was ever injured. So for $535, Libby, what do you think his sentence was in Virginia? $535.
I could not begin to guess.
Take a guess. One guess.
5 years.
Okay. 2 life sentences plus 130 years for $535. My point is, I could sit here all morning and give you these instances of the pardons that I did of the inequities in our criminal justice system. So my point is, racism exists. We got to deal with it. We got to talk about it. We got to quit talking about it and start doing something about it. You got to lean in on schools. We got to reform our criminal justice system, because we're going to have those tenets of racism going forward. And people got to quit thinking that we've dealt with the issues. We haven't. We got to do a better job in school. And I talk about it at the end of the book. K-6, you are not born this way. You aren't. You are not born saying, I want to burn Jews like I burned you in Auschwitz. You're not. That develops horribly. And some starts at home, but we got to do a better job in school. Now in Virginia, beginning K-6, we teach diversity, inclusion, tolerance, dealing with one another. We, you know, this is as important as math or English or history or the other things. We've got to, with our young folks today, young children in school, they've got to understand what the world is like and how you have to treat everybody with dignity and respect.
It appears the shooter in El Paso was somebody who went on this message board that promotes violence and racial purity,
yep,
and applauds people who go on shooting sprees. So the attacks in New Zealand, Christchurch, New Zealand, yep, and the synagogue attacks, multiple attacks on places of worship of Jewish people in recent years. Many attacks had gained fans and followings and then copycats because of this internet platform.
Yep.
Do we need to address those companies that provide a platform for hate?
Absolutely. They are as culpable as anyone else. And our law, as you saw Director Ray of the FBI the other day on terrorism, half the cases they are now are not international terrorism, are domestic terrorism. So they got to ramp up. This gentleman, we could have probably flagged on social media and in the work that they do through, you know, cybersecurity intelligence work. We've got to do a better job of getting a hold of these folks early, finding them, confiscating guns from them. We need these red flag laws. They need to be passed around the country, and then nationally we need to do it. We need universal background checks. You know, as governor, I put bills up every year. My Republicans stop them every single year. The NRA is based in Virginia. When I ran for governor, I'm very proud. I'm the first Democratic nominee for governor to get an F rating from the NRA. And I was proud of it. But there are too many guns. We've got to close the gun show loophole down. But we've got to come together and deal with this issue. And to me, education is a big piece of it. Early on, kindergarten through six, begin to talk these basic tenets of, you know, how we deal with one another.
One thing the president brought up, and a number of Republicans this week, Kevin McCarthy of Bakersfield, one of them, video games, media, Hollywood, things in our culture, they say promote violence. It really gave me flashbacks to Columbine. I was a yep. kid back then, but I remember being told that Marilyn Manson was responsible for Columbine. You know, it turns out those kids weren't even really Marilyn Manson fans. I mean, this was just a kind of a red herring that was thrown up and a distraction. Do you think there is a conversation about the role of media in glorifying violence here? Or when we talk about video games in the wake of a shooting in El Paso, is that throwing up a distraction?
A little bit of both. I think we have to do more. I think we've got to put everything on the table as it relates to media companies and what is out there and these dangerous games that are out there. But for the President of the United States to come out and talk about video games and talk about hate speech in his speech, Libby, what Donald Trump should have done the other day is to come out in front of the country and say, I'm sorry, my rhetoric has created a lot of issues in this country of racial division, and I'm going to stop it. That's what he should have done if he truly was a leader. He blamed all this hate speech, but he's the king hate speech man himself. I mean, we had just gone through Elijah Cumming and rat-infested Baltimore. He had told these four members of Congress to go home. Well, three of them were born here in America. I mean, this is his rallies. You know, he allows them the chance, send her home. How long did we hear lock her up? I mean, the way women were treated in his, you know, campaign rallies. So, I mean, he is the chief progressive of all this. I hold him culpable on all this. I don't blame the president for specific acts, but he has created this environment in our country that people feel it's okay. If they hear the president saying these horrible things, they say to themselves, well, heck, if he can do it, so can I. He is inflaming these issues, and he's creating real tensions in our country. And the next president will be a Democrat, and the first job will be to really heal this country.
That is a Democratic governor, former governor of Virginia, also former chairman of the DNC,
yep.
Terry McAuliffe, and his new book is Beyond Charlottesville, Taking a Stand Against White Nationalism. We are going to talk about the latest headlines in the gun control conversation, because hand in hand with the issue of radicalization and white nationalism this week, conversations about how to keep guns out of the hands of people who mean to do harm is back at the top of our minds. It's back in the national conversation. I want to talk about that coming up next. It's Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle on Air Talk. Back in a minute. Welcome back to Air Talk. Governor Terry McAuliffe in the studio with me right now. Again, gun control. It's a separate issue, but it's related to what's been going on in the country in recent years. Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, was on a Kentucky radio station yesterday, and he talked about possible gun control legislation, discussions he's had with the president about what might be done about gun control. He mentioned red flag laws and said background checks will be part of a conversation. He said front and center when Congress is back from summer recess. Let's listen to part of what Mitch McConnell said yesterday.
It's a horrendous problem, and we've seen it over and over and over again. And it's unfortunately, most of the time, we've ended up in a partisan gridlock. I'd like to see that avoided this time. I think there's a chance that it will be avoided this time.
This time, he thinks that there's a chance. Mitch McConnell obviously controls what legislation comes up on the Senate floor. There were two bills recently passed by the Democratic-controlled House involving background checks. But the conversation now is turning to this Toomey Manchin bipartisan piece of legislation from a few years ago. And it involves closing the gun show loophole. Yep. And there's a few concessions for, you know, interstate sale of guns so that you can bring some Republicans on board. Why is this a different moment? Do you think that Mitch McConnell is being genuine when he says that this could actually move forward?
I mean, it's almost unbelievable to hear him say we got to stop the partisan gridlock. I mean, he is the creator of the partisan gridlock. As you're right, I mean, we had a bill passed 165 days ago in the House on universal background checks that the Senate has refused to take action. 94% of Americans are for background checks. I hope this time is different. You know, I'm the ultimate optimist, but we've seen this over and over again. As governor, as I say, I put up 23 gun bills. They were all defeated early in the morning, 6:30, by the Republicans in subcommittee. They're bought and paid for by the NRA. They are terrified of the NRA. They are terrified in a primary that the NRA will come against them, and they will, due to all these gerrymandered districts in America, they're terrified that they lose their seat. We need background checks. I put up background checks, assault weapon ban, magazine capacity ban. But the gun show loophole, I don't know, Libby, if you've ever been to one. I have. We have a lot of them in Virginia. They're underneath big, huge circus tents with hundreds of vendors, and they all have tables loaded with guns and signs that say, we don't do background checks. You could literally go in and buy as many guns as you want. You could outfit an army. And there's no restriction against it. So until we close this gun show loophole, because right now federally licensed gun dealers like Walmart and a lot of the Dick's Sporting Goods, they do background checks, but not the gun show. So we can have it for the federally licensed stores, but that doesn't mean anything. The people who are intent on doing harm are going to go to a gun show. We need to shut all gun show loopholes. Look what you go through to get a driver's license, to get on an airplane. We ought to do the same thing to buy a gun in this country. Maybe it will be different. I don't know. The NRA is in a very weakened position now. Their leadership is all conflicted. You know, they've all in trouble for using their NRA money for personal use. So they are in a very low point right now. So maybe this will be the point that we can finally get it done. But it's all talk with these Republicans. Pass the bill.
You know, a Second Amendment rights advocate would say getting on an airplane or driving your car, that's not a constitutionally protected right. The Second Amendment is. Why is, you know, controlling the gun sales, why is controlling what guns can be purchased by people going to solve what people who are meaning to do unlawful things anyway will do regardless?
You know, I always hear that argument. I always find it so foolish. When the Constitution came in, we had people with muskets, if you remember. This is about tyranny and overthrow of government. They were not envisioning back at the birth of our nation in 1776, AK-47s, high-capacity magazines. So I just don't buy it. I think that's a ridiculous argument. We're in a different place today than we were when our country was founded. So, you know, we have to deal with the realities that we have here today. But what is the big deal? I've owned a couple shotguns. I've been burn hunting with my boys. I did background checks. You know what? It takes about 6 minutes. You put your license, they go check with an FBI database, and they come back yes or no. 5-6 minutes. How hard is that for any American who's going to go buy any type of gun? So come on. It's a false argument. Universal background checks and shutting. And I go back to the argument, Libby, we had before. You know, we were talking about the First Amendment rights before. Now you're talking about Second Amendment rights. There is superseding concerns about keeping your citizens safe. And that, to me, supersedes both First Amendment and Second Amendment. Just because we have these things written in our Constitution does not mean that gives you the liberty to go out and kill people. I'm sorry. I just don't buy it.
So, you know, in your after action report, you looked back at what could have been done better with Charlottesville and in the future, what should be done to prevent future events like this. What are the lessons that we can take away from what you learned as governor of Virginia during Charlottesville, and where do we need to go from here?
Well, I think the most important thing, and I talk about that, is we've changed it now in Virginia. We now have a unified command that no longer, if the state's putting up all the resources, are we in a support role, we'll be in a command role with. I think that's an important procedure. But also the permitting processes. I did an executive order on that. Right after Charlottesville, they said they wanted to come to Richmond to go to the Robert E. Lee statue in Richmond. That happened to be a state monument, so that came under my jurisdiction as governor. I immediately canceled all permits for it because the existing permit, this is a roundabout in the middle of a busy street in downtown Richmond. The permit allowed for 5,000 people in this little roundabout. So I canceled that. And I, you know, the ACLU wrote me a nasty letter saying that I was infringing upon First Amendment rights. No, I was doing what I needed to do as governor to keep our community safe. So we've redone all of our permit process. So if we have this type of incident in the future, that permit will show that in what we ultimately did. So they decided not to come to this statue. They said, we're coming to Richmond anyways. And working with the chief of police and the mayor of Richmond, banned poles and sticks and masks. And, you know, like 8 people ended up showing up. So it really worked. I get in control of that permitting process, unified command. I talk about it very granularly in the book, but I think it's important for people to see it. But I think overall, what we have to do is, you and I talked about this, the monitoring of the social media, holding people in these social media companies responsible. And as I say, when we got these red flag laws, if we find someone like we had in El Paso, the ability of the police to go in immediately and take a weapon away from someone.
You talk about granular, you know, event planning and permitting. Sometimes government is boring, and it should be. And that's how you do good government.
Yeah.
A lot of politics hasn't been boring lately. And I think that is turning a lot of people off. You talk about that in the book as well. Governor Terry McAuliffe, Beyond Charlottesville is his new book. Former governor of Virginia. Really quickly, we got about a minute and a half left. Why didn't you run for president? I heard you were flirting with it.
Yeah. In fact, I spent the last year and a half preparing to run. I went to 25 states. I thought we had a great message as a Southern Democrat who was the most progressive, most restoration of rights of any governor in American history, criminal justice reform, biggest investment in education in Virginia history in K-12, took a record deficit, turned it into a record surplus.
Sounds like you're stumping for something right now.
But I thought hard about doing it. And we had 25 folks in the race. Joe Biden's an old buddy of mine. I didn't think Joe Biden was going to run. I spent a lot of time with him. And then finally, he told me he was going to run. So I would have had to sort of get around him. And then, as you know, we had some issues in Virginia with our leadership. So I had to go back. They needed me to go back to run this year's elections. We're going to win the House and Senate, I think, for the first time in 26 years with the governor.
Are you going to be looking at a path back to the governor's mansion in Virginia? Would you run again?
I wouldn't foreclose it. I don't foreclose anything. You know, listen, I love being governor. I love government service. But, you know, I like to lean in. I talk in the book. You got to fight. I'm a big fighter. Yeah. I fight for what I believe in. But I'm all about 19 this year. We'll see what the future holds. I'd like to be, you know, Pope. I'd like to be Tom Brady's backup quarterback. I don't take anything off the table.
Yeah, keep dreaming, sir. Governor Terry McAuliffe, former governor of Virginia. His new book is Beyond Charlottesville, Taking a Stand Against White Nationalism. It's on the New York Times bestseller list. Thank you, sir, for being in studio.
Thank you, Libby. Appreciate it.
Film Week is coming up next. Thanks so much for listening. Well, Larry is away. John Horn's going to take over now.
It's Film Week. I'm John Horn sitting in for Larry Mantle today. Coming up later on today's show, we'll hear from director Tom Shadyac, whose new film, Brian Banks, tells the true story of a high school football star whose NFL dreams were derailed by a false rape allegation. We'll also talk to the man himself, Brian Banks, about watching his life story be made into a movie. But first, joining us to review this week's new releases are Christy Lemire, film critic for KPCC, RogerEbert.com and host of the Breakfast All Day podcast, and Tim Cogshell, critic for KPCC, Alt Film Guide, and Synagogues.com. Tim and Christy, welcome.
Hi, good to see you.
Happy, sir.
So let's start with Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. It's a horror film directed by Andre Overdahl, co-written by the brothers Dan and Kevin Hageman, and Academy Award-winning filmmaker Guillermo del Toro. Christy, why don't you get us going?
And Guillermo del Toro is a producer on this, too. And I think if your kids know some of the stuff he does on television, like Trollhunters and like Three Below, this is a good entryway into horror for them. If they know that brand, this is a good place to really start. It's based on a series of books about some kids who find this haunted mansion, this you know, legendary haunted mansion in their small idyllic town in Pennsylvania. And on Halloween, of course, of all night, they dare to break in and sneak around, and they find this hidden passageway to the basement where the legendarily the daughter of the family had been trapped and she's cursed, and any bad thing that happens has been blamed on this young woman. And they find a book and they take the book, and then stories keep getting written in the book magically on their own. And each story is about somebody in this group. And it's legitimately terrifying at times. It's very tense at times. I mean, it's a little sluggish here and there. Not all of the stories work as well as others. It does have a bit of an episodic structure in that regard. But Zoe Colletti, the young lady who is the lead of this, who finds the book and is fascinated by, you know, gothic horror and the occult, she is great. And there's a real Stranger Things vibe here, too, with kids, you know, in adventures, on the run, getting in over their heads. And it's a lot of fun. I brought my son, and his face was like buried in my shoulder half the time.
Yeah.
He might still be
just
mad
traumatized.
At me.
Yeah.
Interesting. About nine or so, something like that.
He's nine and a half.
Nine and a half or something. And oddly, also a serviceable film for the older horror film goer, too. So, you know, I'm not
like
nine,
us.
I'm not nine and a half.
Okay.
And yeah, serviceable because it had this sort of throwback feel to it. It's set in the 50s. And it has all those sort of 50s horror movie tropes, you know, the actual scare trope and all that kind of stuff. You know, so, you know, it's a throwback to all of that stuff. Interestingly, the young male protagonist is a Mexican American, and some of the issues around that are insinuated into the film. I thought that was pretty sharp on the part of Guillermo. Between him and Andre, I suppose it's an amalgamation of their styles, of what they do. So when we get to the creature effects, that's Guillermo's stuff, that thing running around with its body parts falling all off. That's what Guillermo does. The sort of jump scares and stuff like that, well, that's what Andre does.
We're talking about Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. It's co-written by Guillermo del Toro and the brothers Kevin and Dan Hageman. It's rated PG-13 and it's in wide release. Another movie about kids, maybe not quite as terrifying, Dora and the Lost City of Gold. It's a family adventure based on Nickelodeon's TV series Dora the Explorer. Isabella Moner stars as the title character, along with Eugenio Derbez, Michael Pena, Eva Longoria, and Danny Trejo. James Bobin directs the film. Tim, why don't you get us going?
Well, you know, this is a lot of fun. So Dora, the animated series, began in 2000. In the year 2000, still running to this day, the young woman who's the star of this film was born in 2001. So the cartoon is actually older than her. She played this character before. She's just fantastic. She's just wonderful in every possible way. Off-Broadway kid, just look at her IMDb. It's like ridiculous. As though she's been working since she's 2 or 3 years old. She can sing. She can dance. She can act. She's just wonderful. And she can look in that camera and do those goofy things that Dora does when she looks in the camera right at the audience and says, "Can you say?" Like, and you cannot help but just crack up and fall to pieces as she plays this naive character, Dora, who was raised in the jungle with her little blue monkey and all of that stuff. Now, narratively, this thing jumps around like it has epilepsy. You're watching this movie and you're like, and then suddenly you're like, wait a minute, what? We're just in the jungle? Now we're in this, what's going on in this movie? I think that has something to do with the actual audience of the film.
I don't know that we can make seizure jokes, but you've done it.
Just
we
did.
Just
yeah.
did.
So what Isabella Moner is doing here is so remarkable. It's reminiscent of Amy Adams in Enchanted, in that she is totally delightful. She is guileless. She's innocent. And yet she's writing that fine line of letting you know that she is in on the joke. James Bobin and Nicholas Stoller co-wrote this. They also did the most recent couple of Muppets movies. Nicholas Stoller also wrote Get Him to the Greek and Forgetting Sarah Marshall. So the humor here is so much smarter than you might expect from a live action, full length Dora film. I mean, the idea of seeing Dora the Explorer on the big screen sounds like torture. I get that. This is so fun.
And did you wear your Dora the Explorer backpack when you went to go see it? Because my legitimate question is, does it feel like a very cynical attempt to take this character and extract more from it? Or does it feel like it could stand on its own were it not all the mythology and other things that came before?
It kind of works on both levels in that if you are a little kid seeing it, you're going to love how lively and fun it is. And she's a tremendous heroine. She's smart. She's resourceful. She's brave. She's loyal and kind. But if you're an adult, you will love the fact that they are very affectionately skewering the Dora the Explorer franchise. Like, it's not mean, but they know that you know this stuff is ridiculous and insane, and they have a really good time with that.
And Dora is kind of in on it, too. I mean, there's even a moment when she said, when, you know, he tells her something, and she says, I know, but, you know, I gotta be me. And that's, you know, that's very sharp.
And you didn't answer the question. Did you wear the Dora the Explorer backpack?
I didn't because I was afraid it was going to talk during the movie. I didn't want to disrupt my fellow patrons.
Dora and the Lost City of Gold is written by Matthew Robinson and Nick Stoller and directed by Jason Bobin. Isabella Moner stars, and the film is in wide release and rated PG. Now, The Kitchen, it's a crime drama starring Elizabeth Moss, Melissa McCarthy, Tiffany Haddish, and Donald Gleason. Andrea Berloff directed the film. It's her directorial debut, and it's based on the DC comic book series by Ollie Masters and Ming Doyle. Christy, kind words, not so kind words.
They're going to teach this film in film school someday as an example of what not to do, because this gets everything wrong on every level, every step of the way, in a way that is so shocking, given the level of talent here. I mean, beyond,
other than that, it works.
Beyond the three stars, Melissa McCarthy, Elizabeth Moss, Tiffany Haddish. Beyond them, you have this incredibly deep bench of terrific character actors. Margot Martindale, James Badge Dale, Brian D'Arcy James. It's incredible. Bill Camp. I mean, just people who are consistent. And it is edited in the most erratic, jarring way. There is no cohesion to this, but then there's nothing to these characters anyway. Elizabeth Moss's prime personality trait is that she's good at getting beaten up. And it's got kind of a rich sense of place. Hell's Kitchen in the late 70s. It's super grungy. It's, you know, grimy New York. But it all feels really superficial and rushed, and it never achieves the level of rah-rah female empowerment that it seeks.
And I would say, I've read the comic book. It is a good comic, incredibly graphically violent, but it really had a sense of style and character. And Tim, I assume that went by the wayside as well?
Well, except for the violence.
They kept that part.
They kept that part. And so in the audience that I'm watching this film with, they really enjoyed the violence.
Well, you were at the premiere, weren't you?
I was at the premiere.
Okay.
And they were hooting and hollering when the ladies got to going. Now, Elizabeth Moss' character actually has two traits. One is getting beaten up, and then her character changes completely, and then she develops that other trait, which is shooting people in the head. So it's, you know, that was kind of like, okay, you know, that's quite a character arc right there, you know, for a 90-minute movie. Look, this movie's a mess. It absolutely is a mess. The ladies are really restraining themselves, Tiffany and Melissa particularly, to not tell jokes. You can tell that they're dying to tell jokes, but you can't do that in this movie. You can't stop this movie so that you can have a moment of funny.
But if a movie like this doesn't work, even if it deserves not to work, the consequences, I think, are going to be severe. And that is that a woman can't direct a mob movie and women can't play mobsters. So if it doesn't work, it's going to be seen unfairly, probably, as a referendum on any women doing these kinds of films.
I would hope not, but it also makes Widows from last year look that much better. Widows was very good and it was overlooked. And here is, you know, it can be done and it can be done well. I will say Donald Gleason is good in this. So if you like the hot ginger, Donald Gleason.
Yeah. It's interesting. We'll be talking about that documentary in a little while, Gina Davis's documentary, which, you know, speaks to what you were just talking about there. So we shall see.
So if you want to see mob women, go check out Steve McQueen's movie, Widows. The Kitchen is written and directed by Andrea Berloff, Elizabeth Moss, Melissa McCarthy, and Tiffany Haddish star in the film. It's rated R, and it's in wide release. Now, Brian Banks It's a biographical drama that stars Aldous Hodge, Greg Kinnear, and Tiffany DuPont. Tom Shadyac is the director. It's the first film he's directed in 10 years. More on that later. It tells the story of a high school football standout whose pro dreams are shattered after he's falsely accused of rape by a classmate. Tim, you want to start?
The true story of exactly what you just said. So this is poignant in that way. So he was accused of rape by this person that completely threw his life off track. He goes away to prison for 6 years.
Let me just add here, because I know the story very well. His lawyer thought by accepting a plea deal, he might get a couple of months of probation. He had no record. He didn't have a good lawyer, obviously. He goes, enters his plea because he's afraid of a jury trial. He gets sentenced to 6 years, knowing he's innocent.
Okay, this is the thing that happens very often with young African-American and Latino men who get caught up in the system. They're encouraged to take these plea deals. And in any case, that's what happens. Now, eventually, when he gets out of prison, he gets involved in a situation where he gets a phone call from the young woman. Things happen as you might expect. Now, here's the thing. This is a perfectly serviceable movie. It's a drama. It's well acted. It's well written. It's working, generally speaking. It is unfortunate that this movie has been made and released at this particular moment in history, our Me Too sort of moment, because it goes against the idea of believing women. I can see how some folks are going to use this movie like a baseball bat against the Me Too movement.
It's problematic. It's very tricky, and it's hard not to watch this through that prism. And yeah, and the things that she does, her motivations are everything, every rape myth and misconception. It's like she's lying to protect herself. She's trying to get a big payday. You know, she's trying to turn a situation around to somebody else because of hurt feelings.
Mm-hmm.
So everything that women get accused of when they, you know, make sexual assault allegations, it all happened here. It's really unfortunate, but it's very well. Aldous Hodge is terrific in this. So natural, so charismatic, has tremendous chemistry with Greg Kinnear as the California Innocence Project lawyer who he works with. Everyone's good in this. It's a solidly made film.
You know what the problem is? You know how easy the fix is in this movie? The fix is you don't put her in the movie. You just don't put the accuser in the movie at all.
I understand what you're saying. The problem is, of course, it's a true story, and she did make it up. Brian Banks is the film from director Tom Shadyac. It stars Aldous Hodge and Greg Kinnear. It's rated PG-13. It's in wide release, and you want to stick around because later in the show, we'll talk with Tom Shadyac about leaving filmmaking for a decade, as well as play some of my interview with the real Brian Banks on the set of the film, talking about seeing his life made into a feature. Next up, Art of Racing in the Rain. It's a comedic drama starring Kevin Costner, Milo Ventimiglia, and Amanda Seyfried. Simon Curtis directs the film, and Mark Bombeck wrote the screenplay, which is based on the novel by Garth Stein. Christy.
This is definitely based on a novel, and you can tell that based on the wall-to-wall narration we get from Kevin Costner as the dog Enzo, who is, you know, incredibly wise and philosophical. And I feel like this device probably works a lot better on the page than hearing Kevin Costner's avuncular grumble, you know, to the ears. He is a dog who belongs to Milo Ventimiglia, who is this up-and-coming race car driver. Milo and Amanda Seyfried fall in love, and they get married, and they have a baby, and the dog witnesses all of this. And it is so mawkish. It is just smothered in cloying anthropomorphism from start to finish. I brought my kid to this one, too. It's been a big week for my son.
You didn't bring your dogs?
There were dogs at one of the screenings, but not at this one that I went to. I thought, okay, cool. It's a talking dog movie. You're going to love it. And he's not. It's so much hand-holding, so much spelling out of everything to feel at every moment. You know the second that Amanda Seyfried has a headache and starts coughing, you know what's going to happen. It's just, and her parents are super judgy. Everyone's very two-dimensional. Again, this is probably a very rich and inspirational experience in book form, but as a film, it is really tough to sit through.
The Art of Racing in the Rain is in wide release this week. Kevin Costner, Milo Ventimiglia, and Amanda Seyfried star in the film, directed by Simon Curtis. It's rated PG. Coming up, more reviews are just ahead on Film Week. When we return, we'll talk about the documentary This Changes Everything, which looks at gender disparity in Hollywood and the Peanut Butter Falcon. It's John Horn here in for Larry Mantle today on Film Week. Back with more in just a minute.
Music.
It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm John Horn in today for Larry Mantle. We're joined by our Film Week critics, Tim Cogshell of Alt Film Guide and Cinegods.com, and Christy Lemire of RogerEbert.com and host of the Breakfast All Day podcast. Let's move on to This Changes Everything. It's a documentary that looks at gender disparity in Hollywood. It's directed by Tom Donahue and features firsthand stories told by some of the biggest names in Hollywood, including Gina Davis, Meryl Streep, and Natalie Portman. Tim, why don't you start us on This Changes Everything?
Well, you know, to say this is a very important thing might sound a little bit backhanded, but it really is a very important film. It's about this. It's about women on screen, actual screen time, how much time they are on screens, our screens, as compared to men. It's about women, what women are asked to do when they're on screen, everything from what they're asked to wear to what they're asked to say. It's about women behind the camera and how there aren't women in all of those powerful positions behind the camera. It's about women in the executive suites who, by the way, get to decide about all of those other things I just mentioned and how they're not there either. And obviously, these positions are not being held by women in percentages that make any sense in juxtaposition to how many women there are in the country. What's funny about this film is that everything that's said in this film regarding women in all of those circumstances can be applied to black people and Latino people and Asian people. You can swap, but for the numbers here or there, you can swap it all out. Now, what does this mean about Hollywood? Hollywood, the power structure, is literally discriminating against everyone all the time, every day, except for white men of a certain age.
And straight white men.
Straight white men. And now, there are a few brave studio executives that are in this, but there are many more who are not. They don't show up. They should have named names. They should have named the names of the studio executives that they invited to be in this film who did not come.
No, they asked, and I talked to Gina about this, and none of them would come on camera. Got something to hide.
This is, of course, it's an important topic, and it's a very timely topic, and it's a mind-boggling array of A-listers who are, you know, talking about this. Besides the ones that we mentioned, also Jessica Chastain, Rashida Jones, Taraji P. Henson. She and Cate Blanchett have a great anecdote about how they will take the, you know, flimsily written girlfriend role and punch it up and make it much more interesting than it actually is on the page. A lot of great anecdotes here, but it almost tries to get its arms around too much because it's also about various lawsuits. It's also about something I had no idea about, how much more powerful women were in the silent era. And the fact that when the talkies came along, that changed the financing at the studios and put the banks in charge. And then the studio heads, who were all straight white men, wanted to please the banks. And that's why you had that going on for decades. That's a fascinating bit here. It tries to do a lot, and it's really interesting. And then the credits roll.
Yeah.
And the first thing you see is directed by Tom Donahue.
I will explain that because I asked Gina Davis this. He was working on the film before she got involved as an executive producer and as somebody who's interviewed. It was well on its way down the road, and she's like, this is going to get made. This guy knows what he's talking about. She didn't hire him. It was his project, so he is an ally, even if it's a documentary directed by a man. And the one thing I will add, my favorite anecdote, Natalie Portman talks about all the movies that she's been in. She's been directed by a woman twice, and one of those times was herself.
That's crazy.
This Changes Everything is the documentary from director Tom Donahue. It's unrated. You can see it at the Arena Cine Lounge Sunset and Lemley's Monica Film Center in Santa Monica. Now, the Peanut Butter Falcon, it comes to us from first-time directors Tyler Nielsen and Michael Schwartz. Shia LaBeouf and Dakota Johnson star along with Zach Gottsagen, who makes his feature acting debut as the lead here. Christy.
This movie is shockingly great. And on paper, it
shockingly great.
Yeah, because on paper, it sounds really mawkish. And it could have been really twee and adorable. And there's this fascinating combination of gritty realism with like a heightened kind of fairy tale romanticism going on here at once. It reminded me a bit of Beasts of the Southern Wild. Not that extreme aesthetically, but that same kind of idea. It's about this really unlikely friendship between this 22-year-old man named Zach, played by Zach Gottsagen, who has Down syndrome. And he escapes from the home where he is living because he has these dreams of being a wrestler. And along the way, he meets up with Shia LaBeouf, who is this outlaw crab fisherman who's on the run from all the people he has wronged, including John Hawks. It's this incredible supporting cast. And the two of them become friends. And then Dakota Johnson, who works at the home, finds them and becomes like this kind of makeshift family with them. It is lovely and funny and never condescending for a second. And that's what I loved about it. They all have great chemistry with each other.
And Tim, I want to pick up on something you mentioned about the Gina Davis documentary, and that is people with disabilities who often are not either cast or they're played by able-bodied actors. So how important is it that Zach Gottsagen, who has Down syndrome, plays himself?
Very, very important. And let me, I think it was Corky on the television series called Life Goes On. Was that the name of that series? And I think he's the last person I can remember who actually had, you know, whatever, and played themselves in the thing. And that's in the 80s, if I'm not mistaken, maybe the 90s.
It was a long time ago. So,
but Zach is very, very good. He's very knowing. He's very aware. He's not parodying or anything like that. He's engaged in these dramatic and comedic moments. And man, he can he has timing.
He has great timing.
He can deliver a line. Shia. Yeah, I've been saying on this show for years. I know Shia, he comes with baggage. Shia LaBeouf. Shia LaBeouf can act. Shia LaBeouf can act. And let me point out that he's one of the few, you know, movie stars who plays characters.
Right.
He's playing Huck Finn in this. This is Huck Finn and Tom Sawyer.
Mm-hmm.
But what's funny is he's playing Huck. And the other kid's playing Tom Sawyer. And Becky goes for a ride down the raft. And so this is really intriguing. So everyone is just doing really, really good work here, and I thoroughly enjoy it.
This is the best work Shia has done in a little while. Mm. Yeah,
wow.
It's great.
Peanut Butter Falcon is the film featuring the acting debut of Zach Gottsagen. He stars alongside Shia LaBeouf and Dakota Johnson. Tyler Nilsson and Michael Schwartz wrote and directed the film. It's rated PG-13. It's playing at the Landmark Theater in West L.A., the Arclight Hollywood, the Regal Edwards West Park in Irvine, and Regency Theater's Director's Cut Cinema in Laguna Niguel. Now, One Child Nation. It's a documentary from Amazon Studios about China's one-child policy. Nanfu Wang and Jiling Zhang co-directed the film. It won the U.S. Grand Jury Prize for Documentaries at this year's Sundance Film Festival. This is another movie that you all are discussing that I have seen. Difficult to watch, but really important, Tim.
I thought that I knew something about that policy. More or less went into effect in about 1979, about 40 years ago, when I was graduating from high school. It was a big news story here in the United States. We sort of used government American propaganda to beat up China about that one-child policy. It's stated at the beginning of this film that the Chinese government feels that the one-child policy was effective and correct. And in some ways, they were right. China would certainly not be the economic powerhouse that it is today with, you know, relative prosperity had they kept having children at the rate that they were having children now.
Because there might have been a horrible famine.
Almost more than likely. It's just math, you know, at the end of the day. That's just math. All right. Now, what I thought I knew about this, I knew nothing about this. We think that it was just a matter of everybody just have one child and that'll be. No. It's about the things that they engaged in and did to mostly make sure that only one child was born. And then it's about the thing that happened to the female children because they favored the boys. And difficult, man, you're not kidding.
It's stunning. It's sickening. It's heartbreaking. And Nanfu Wang grew up in China and comes back with her own child who is a boy. And being a mother makes her consider all of this through a totally different prism. It's this heart-wrenching expose for a long time. And then it becomes a thriller when it goes into the whole adoption process and what white American parents think they are getting themselves into when they adopt a baby from China, and a discovery of what the truth behind those stories often actually is. This is tough to watch, but necessary.
Yeah, and there's also an interview with a midwife who has performed, by her counts, tens of thousands of forced sterilizations and abortions, very late term, where fetuses are delivered live and she has to kill them. And she has this, you know, moment where she figures she's going to atone for her sins and becomes an advocate for people with infertility. So it's really interesting how this story has changed, even if the policy has gone away. One Child Nation is co-directed by Nanfu Wang and Jialing Zhang. The film is rated R. You can see it at Lemley's Royal Theater in West L.A. And if you're interested in learning more about the film and director Nanfu Wang, I interviewed her earlier this week on The Frame. You could find that interview linked on the Film Week page at kpcc.org.
Next up, After the Wedding, it's a drama starring Michelle Williams and Julianne Moore. Bart Freundlich is the director of the film. It's a remake of a 2006 Danish film of the same name. Christy.
Yeah, this is a Susanne Bier film, and they have remade it, but switched the gender of the characters as far as who makes discoveries about whom. But it's a tremendous cast, and that would seem to be reason for hope, and yet it is just this very restrained and tasteful melodrama. So Michelle Williams plays a young woman who works at an orphanage in India. She gets this call that a ton of money could come her way to help support these kids from a donor in New York, but she has to fly to New York City to meet this person. That person is Julianne Moore. She's this media titan, and she's married to Billy Crudup, and their daughter is about to get married that weekend that Michelle Williams is in town. So Julianne Moore invites her to their palatial home and says, come on, we'll get to know each other better. Come to the house, come to the wedding. And Michelle Williams does and makes a discovery. And they all make a discovery.
That involves Billy Crudup.
That changes everyone's lives forever. And it's a lot of like really good looking, wealthy white people being sad in beautifully decorated rooms. It's a lot of that.
I will say, though, and Michelle Williams can be so good in even mediocre movies, and I think she is just amazing in this film. It's a tough part to play, given how much is not written and what she has to do with the part, but I thought Michelle was very good in it. It opened the Sundance Film Festival earlier this year, but outside of Michelle, not a lot to recommend.
She's incredibly subtle. She really is. And no one cries like Julianne Moore, and she gets to cry big here. Mm. And there are some subtle images and moments that stuck out for me, like Michelle Williams taking off her shoes to run down a flight of stairs in this high rise because she's accustomed to walking around barefoot around the orphanage. Things like that, of her feeling stuck between two cultures. You really feel that push-pull of doing the right thing but also being tied to this history. It's okay.
It
should be
okay.
Better. Given who all is in it, though, you'd have reason to have high expectations.
Yeah. We're talking about After the Wedding. It's from writer-director Bart Freundlich. It stars Michelle Williams and Julianne Moore. It's rated PG-13, and you can see it at the Landmark Theater in West L.A. Ode to Joy. Mm. It's a romantic comedy starring Martin Freeman and Marina Baccarin. Jason Winter directed the film, and Max Warner adapted the screenplay from a true story by Chris Higgins from This American Life. Tim.
Yeah. You know, this movie's quirky. It's quirky. It's full of quirky people. Look, I hate quirky people in movies.
Do you hate them in real life, too?
No, I'm quirky in real life. That's perfectly good. No, in movies. And generally speaking, if you're going to have a quirky, you get one quirky person per movie. Everybody in this movie is quirky. The guy who has Martin Freeman's character, he has this disease. And it's a real disease. I looked it up. And if you get hit by these emotions, you're paralyzed and faint, right? And it's based on a true story. The guy really had this disease. So therefore, he avoided relationships and babies and cute puppies and all that kind of stuff because he was fainting all over the place. This beautiful woman comes into his life. He falls in love with her, but he can't be with her because he knows it's just going to be a mess. And we go through all this stuff. Now, here's the thing. As much as I'm sounding like I hate this movie, I like this movie. This movie is so charming. It's so smart and funny. Martin Freeman can deliver any line of dialogue at all. And you just giggle. You can't help yourself. And she is incredibly beautiful and so funny. And so, you know, it got me. I don't know that this American Life story, but this movie full of quirky people ultimately got me.
And you didn't feel like fainting.
No.
Coming up, we're talking about Ode to Joy. It's a romantic comedy starring Martin Freeman and Marina Baccarin. Jason Winter directed the film. It's rated R and playing at Lemley's Monica Film Center in Santa Monica. Coming up on Film Week, we'll dig deeper into the making of the film Brian Banks. It's out in wide release this week. We'll talk with Brian himself about the movie based on his own life story. We're also going to hear from director Tom Shadyac on why Brian's story spoke to him. I'm John Horn, in for Larry Mantle. We'll be back right after this. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm John Horn, in for Larry Mantle today. In case you missed our review of the film earlier in the show, one of the movies that's out in wide release this week is Bleecker Street's Brian Banks. It's the story of a highly regarded high school football player whose dreams of playing in college and the pros ended after a classmate falsely accused him of rape. Rather than risk a jury trial, Banks accepted a plea deal, having been told by his lawyer he would probably get probation, but a judge sentenced him to 6 years behind bars. Banks was ultimately exonerated a decade after his arrest. While Banks landed a couple of tryouts and played in exhibition games with the NFL after his name was cleared, his dream of pro football never became a reality. Now, Brian says he's using his platform to try to help others who are wrongfully accused and convicted. When I sat down with Brian on the set of the film Brian Banks in Memphis 2 summers ago, I started by asking him about the first time that someone suggested his story could be turned into a film and how he reacted.
I think it was in an article by a writer from ESPN. And it was one of the articles. They said, this is like right out of a movie or you know, written right out of a movie. And the next thing you know, it kind of became like a catchy thing that a lot of the reporters would say, this story is as if it was a movie. And I think maybe it was no more than a week or so after being exonerated that I began to receive requests from different producers and directors that were interested in actually making my story into a film. And in a way, not a huge way, but in a way, it was somewhat of a bidding war where when we had an opportunity to sit with different people that are huge in the industry who've made, you know, every major film that you can think of. And we met. And then eventually we had an opportunity to sit with a woman by the name of Amy Bear. And I remember that interview or that meeting took, it was probably, we sat for almost about 3 hours and we just talked and we talked and we talked. And the thing that stood out from her amongst a lot of other people was that she got it. Like she really, truly understood the story and she realized that it wasn't a football story. And she realized that it wasn't a prison story, that this was a story about someone who experienced something that was of the unexpected. Something that they didn't want to experience, but they did. And I guess I'm speaking to myself, but how this person went through such hard times, but still was able to grieve while moving forward and pursuing what they felt was the best for them in this world. But yeah, Amy Bear was the first person we met with, and she is why we are all here today.
What was it important to you in terms of the movie that any filmmaker was going to make? And why was Tom, in your first meetings with him, important? What did he say to you that made you think that he understood the story that you wanted to have told as opposed to the story that you didn't want to have told?
My mentor would always say, you have 2 eyes, 2 ears, and 1 mouth. Listen and see more than you speak. And I think what was different about Tom is that Tom listened more than he spoke when he and I had an opportunity to talk. And I think the questions that when he finally did speak, the questions that he asked were more questions about spirituality, questions about, you know, faith, questions about perseverance and what kept you going. And just the many things that I think as human beings, we are challenged with day by day is how do we grieve with things in our lives while still being able to move forward? And then to wrap it, you know, to even add to that, Tom, with his own personal experiences of, you know, having a near-death accident, almost losing his life, and having that moment of self-realization that the world was so much bigger than he once perceived. I think that me and him have so much in common, obviously on two different levels, but still that experience of almost losing everything unexpectedly and having an opportunity to become a better you.
I think that's where your life and his life are most similar. And obviously what you went through is nowhere near as horrific as, well, I mean, what happened to Tom was very serious about his bike accident and having post-concussion syndrome. But I think the similarity is you both had a moment that, you know, God, somebody gave you a moment and said, you're going to have a chance to reevaluate who you are and what you can be. And both of you made decisions for the better. Both of you, through, you know, circumstances not of your own creation, had a chance to do something different and to change your life and to come out of a bad experience with a positive attitude. And that, to me, is where your lives are most similar. And I wonder if you had conversations with him about that second chance and about what it meant to be able to do something different going forward.
We've had many opportunities to have that discussion. And I think, well, one thing that we both agree on, which really stuck with me and is still with me today is, you know, it's not what you go through, but how you allow it to affect you and what you choose to do as a response moving forward. And, you know, I've always told people, and I, one of the first things I told Tom is, don't judge me by what I've been through. Judge me by how I dealt with it. And because therein lies true character. And I think that's where he and I think have a lot of similarities, is that he went through something that was so severe and so tragic. But it wasn't the experience. It was how he responded to it and what he chose to do as a response to it. And he's a better person today than he was before the accident. And that's a choice. And I think, you know, and this may be a little bit of trailing off, but I just feel like that's the most powerful tool that we have as human beings, is the power of choice. That if we really truly understood that we control our emotions, we are the creator of our emotions. Our emotions do not control or create us. And if we really understand that, then we also understand that we are the master of our choices, which means that we can make these choices and we can have these emotions and give emotions to things. And it's not the other way around, where emotions come first. It's what we give to experiences and give to situations. And, you know, Tom could have gone through what he went through and allowed it to make him a more stressful person, a sadder person, a why me kind of person. But he didn't. He stood up to the plate. He said, this is my life. This is my experience. Even though unwanted, it's here. So what am I going to do next? And I think that's where we both connect, is we went through things that we didn't want to go through, but it happened. And we chose to make positive decisions for ourselves that brings a lot of light and positivity to other people.
It's unimaginable to think about what you went through, but you're having to relive it, because what this movie is doing is revisiting how bad evidence was admitted, how it was used to put you behind bars, the decision that you made at the point of a gun in terms of accepting a plea. What is it like to watch your life replayed in all of the horrible things that happened to you? To me, it's a little bit like Joe Thye has been watching his ankle get broken on slow-mo. It's like, I don't want to see that. I can't go there. But you were on set watching this.
No, actually, absolutely. You know, there are parts of this film that while it's being filmed, I won't show up. I won't come onto set that day. For example, the arrest scene when I was arrested at home, and, you know, my mother, I remember my mom, you know, dropping to her knees and screaming as loud as she could and pleading to God to not let this happen, you know? And so when they recreate scenes like that, there's no way I'd be close to it. You know, I'll wait for this film to come out to have to deal with that part. But then there's a lot of other parts that, although are tough to be around, for the purpose of authenticity and, you know, truthfulness and what really happened, I feel like it's my duty to be there. Because at the end of the day, this movie is not only just for me or the California Innocence Project, but the many other people who have experienced wrongful accusation, a wrongful conviction, or may experience it somewhere near in the future. And so I would like for this film to be as accurate as possible for those who understand what this life is about. They can sit there and watch this film and go, yeah, that's how it really goes down, you know. And then it also gives people who have never experienced it or know nothing about this world to get a true and accurate POV of this is what it is to be wrongfully convicted. This is what it is to be picked up off the street for something you didn't do. And by the time that they figured out that they made a mistake, 10 years of your life have passed. And, you know, it's hard to describe. I think this film will give people a better insight into it.
Brian, thanks a lot.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
That was my interview with former high school football standout Brian Banks, who's the subject of a new film that carries his name. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. And coming up, I'll play you some of my interview with director Tom Shadyac, where we talk about the making of the film and how Tom and Brian's very different life stories share an important common thread. We're back in a minute. Welcome back to Film Week. I'm John Horn, hosting for Larry Mantle today. We're talking about the new film, Brian Banks, which is in wide release starting this weekend. It tells the story of a standout athlete from Long Beach who saw his football dreams destroyed when he was accused and convicted of raping a high school classmate. It's a crime he did not commit. It cost him a college scholarship, his chance at playing pro football, and 6 years of his life behind bars. The film is directed by Tom Shadyac, whom you may know as the director of comedy films like Liar Liar, Bruce Almighty, and Ace Ventura, Pet Detective. In 2007, a mountain biking accident left Shadyac with post-concussion syndrome symptoms that were so severe he felt his life might be ending. He had an epiphany, sold everything he owned, and moved to Memphis, and he went off the grid for a decade while still trying to get work in film. Finally, in 2017, Shadyac was approached about directing the Brian Banks movie. When I sat down with Shadyac on the set of the film in Memphis, I asked him what it was like to get back behind a camera after 10 years.
It all came rushing back in an instant. The only thing was a little bit of screen direction, you know, looking right, entering left, going, et cetera. But no, it all came back, including how hard it is. It's so doggone hard. But yeah, I feel like I'm home again.
I want to ask about teachable moments, because you started today's shooting by talking to the extras, and you didn't just say, here's what this scene's about, here's what you need to do. You really talked about the importance of Brian Banks's life and the importance of his story and what they, as extras in this scene, could take away from this day of work.
First of all, I don't call them extras, and I hope in our business we can move beyond that. An extra is something you have, something you don't need. I have two glasses of water. There's one extra. These guys are essentials. I call them essentials or background actors. But yeah, to me, it's one idea. If you want someone, I don't view art in a compartment. Like, we don't just make movies about justice if we're unjust to people as we make movies. So I think everything has a holistic idea to me, and I want people in that room to understand Brian's story so they can roll forward the energy that is Brian, their desire to create a more just world. That room could be as important as any room that ever sees the movie.
Why was this the movie that you had to make at this time? How did this movie speak to you, and why was it something that you felt compelled to direct?
Well, because I'd experienced it. I think, and you said earlier that I had left show business for 10 years. Now, I got hurt a few years ago. You can see that documented in the film I made called I Am. And that pulled me away for a couple of years. But I've been trying to get a gig for about 10 years. And everybody said, thank you. And then there's this rumor that I retired, and it's not true. So being a creative person who wants to stay involved and active, I started teaching, and I've been teaching for 11 years. And that drew me to Memphis because I have family here. We helped to found St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. And I taught here, and I experienced the themes of these movies through the lives of my students. I saw kids arrested for being black. I saw the injustice that Brian experienced on maybe a more intense scale happen to my students, thrown in jail for crimes they didn't commit with no evidence and no resources to get the legal help that they needed to argue their case, to prove their innocence. And I could feel it in my heart. And when I read Brian's story, and as much or more when I met him, because Brian is the right microphone for this ideology, he went through an extraordinarily difficult shadow, but came out beaming like the sun. And I met him and knew that it was something that I wanted to be a part of, to try to bring this story to the world as emblematic of a larger issue in this country.
There are things that are parallel in my mind between what you went through and what Brian Banks went through, and I'm not going to compare them, but both of you had horrific things happen to you that were none of your own doings. Brian was unjustly accused of a crime he didn't commit and served multiple years in jail for that crime. You had a bike accident and suffered post-concussion syndrome. But both of you had what I will call an epiphany. You had a moment where you were able to kind of step outside of your lives and look at your lives in a new and different way and come out the other side with new direction, new focus, new perspective. Do you think that your lives, even though they're not identical, have some sort of mirrors in them, and that what happened to Brian spoke to you on a level beyond just filmmaker who sees a good story, that there was some connection beyond that?
Yes, I think there's a good, and I'm not likening what I've gone through to the deep pain that Brian's gone through, but yes, there's an absolute parallel, and not just with me and Brian, but you and Brian and everyone in Brian. It is the hero's journey. We face obstacles. Brian's was an intense obstacle of losing 5, 10 years of his life, a chance to play professional football, a chance to earn a living and help his mother, who had been working so hard for years. And he turned that darkness when he was unjustly accused of a crime, and he's turned it into light. He is literally the lump of coal that has been crushed into a diamond. And that's the opportunity that we all have. I had a concussion, and I faced my own death. And it helped me, as I reinvented myself, to drop fear in a more powerful way. The fear that said these ideas that you've had, don't talk about them. That's why I made the movie I Am. This sense, this urgency that you have to make a difference, just push that aside and go out and make another comedy, which is important. It's important that the world laugh, and I value that. I think it's a sacred art. But there is more articulation to my spirit that wanted to happen. Again, I think it's a story we all share, and I hope when people see this movie that it's certainly not a prison movie. It's a movie about what you do when the worst thing happens to you. And we're hoping that people will see Brian's story and say, you know what, if he can survive that and even thrive through that, then I can make it through my difficulty as well.
Why do you think people didn't want to hire you? When you say you've been looking for a gig and you couldn't get one, what did you hear? What did people tell you why they didn't want to put you on a movie or a TV show?
Well, they said no. They said, you know, I can't tell you how many jobs that I applied for where they just didn't hire me. So you'll have to ask them. I mean, a lot of friends said that's impossible. Your track record is pretty impeccable, and I have a strong track record. I've been blessed with a lot of what you'd call commercial success. I mean, on a subconscious level, I think in some ways maybe it's, nobody's conscious about this, but subconsciously maybe I felt like I got sober and nobody wants the sober person in the opium den, you know? And so I sort of knew the day that I stopped flying privately because I didn't need to. Some celebrities do. It's I understand that, you know? I didn't need to, and there's a lot of resources that I could go ahead and give to people who needed them more. I sort of knew that day that I had left, you know, I had left the private club, and it was a matter of time before the private club didn't want me back in.
Because why? You were repudiating what they believed in. You were a traitor to the cause. I mean, again, imagining what it is that they imagined you had done. What was your betrayal?
Well, you have to ask people their own individual stories, and I don't want to I love everybody in show business. I'm as imperfect as anybody in show business, but you know, we're all mirrors for each other, right? And maybe, you know, having me around wasn't a thing that they wanted to look at.
Tom Shadyac, great to see you.
Thank you, brother.
That was my interview with director Tom Shadyac on the set of his film, Brian Banks. It's in wide release this weekend. And that'll do it for this week's edition of Film Week. You can listen to us live every Friday at 11, again on Saturdays at noon, and anytime via the Film Week podcast, which you can find wherever you like to get podcasts. I'm John Horn, in for Larry Mantle. Have a great weekend.